This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Talk show host and political commentator Tavis Smiley currently hosts PBS's late-night TV talk show, Tavis Smiley, and Public Radio International's The Tavis Smiley Show. He's also a New York Times best-selling author with 18 books under his belt. His latest, My Journey with Maya, chronicles Tavis's decades-old friendship with Dr. Maya Angelou. He'll share his work with Triad audiences next week, courtesy of Bookmarks. Tavis spoke with me by phone from his studio in Los Angeles. He says the focus of his new book is the many ways in which Dr. Angelou's words and actions continue to impact his life today. His journey with Maya began shortly after college when Tavis was invited by a mutual friend, economist and author Julianne Malveaux, to accompany them on a trip to Africa.
And so this was my first trip out of the country, my first trip to Africa. So to take all of this in, the speeches that she was giving and the lectures, of course, and the government officials, you know, who were waiting to meet her. You know, long before I met Barack Obama as a black president, I met a black president in Africa, Jerry John Rawlings, the president of Ghana at the time. We were staying in the presidential palace. And so I'm meeting the president of the country. And on that trip, Stokely Carmichael was there and Miriam Makeba was there. So you got all these great figures, you know, these iconic figures in this one place. We're in Africa. And I'm taking all this in. And it was overwhelming. I was taking copious notes every night, David, trying to make sure that for the rest of my life I'd never forget this trip, which I knew was going to not just be life-affirming, but indeed life-altering. And that's exactly what it was.
Sure. And I can understand how, I mean, you referred to that as being overwhelming. Throughout the book, you're offered so many life lessons and how you respond to these things, and the dynamics of the conversation really grabbed me. She offers you advice, relatively early on about listening not with your ears, but with your heart.
And that's right.
Could you recall that exchange and how you've incorporated that into your role, today as an interviewer?
It is about being compassionate. It's about being concerned. I mean, genuinely compassionate and genuinely concerned and genuinely empathetic. Maya taught me early on the difference between being sympathetic and being empathetic. People don't need your sympathy, she'd say, Tavis. What they do need and deserve, quite frankly, is your empathy. Mm. So I learned the difference between sympathy and empathy, and I learned the difference between talking and listening. My grandfather said to me all the time, there's a reason why you have one mouth and two ears. So there is a value that even our Creator, I think, places on us listening more than talking. But the point that Dr. Angelou was passing on to me, or Mother Maya, as I called her, the point she wanted me to get across is that I had to learn how to be a generous listener, a generous listener. And you become a generous listener not just by listening with your ears, but by listening with your heart as well. And I hope I've learned that lesson well. I certainly apply that to my broadcast work every day. To the extent that I'm reasonably good at what I do, it's because, unlike others, I'm less interested in talking when I'm on the set and more interested in listening. And so I try to ask questions, get out of the way, and let the guest lead the conversation, although to most of us we think that the interviewer is leading the conversation. But if you're listening generously, the guest will tell you what the next question is, where to take this conversation about what he or she just said, if you're listening generously. And I learned that lesson from Maya Angelou.
Yeah, I had the great fortune of meeting with her here in Winston-Salem, and I was struck by just how easy the conversation went and how comfortable I felt, even though I obviously revered her as a person.
Sure.
It says a lot about her.
Absolutely.
I love, as a lifelong lover of jazz, Tavis, I love the dinner conversation you share between you and Dr. Angelou, in which she says, yes, it all comes down to jazz. And she speaks to that, the importance of improv and relaxation. And she's talking about just being in the moment, as a black person living in America 200 years ago and today, puts it in that historical perspective. It was so poetic. I love the strength of improvisation as portrayed anywhere, and was curious about, synthesizing that conversation. A few examples that interest you most in the improvisation of others or in your own life.
What I love about that, I'm so glad you raised that. What I loved about that conversation we had over dinner that night, I recall that was at Hal's Restaurant here in Venice, California, not too far from where I'm sitting right now on Crenshaw in my office. But that conversation got me to appreciate life as being jazz-like. I had never really considered the parallel, the relationship between life and jazz. And what I took away from that conversation and still hold on to this day is that life affords us the opportunity to be a part of an ensemble, that none of us makes it on our own. Every one of us has to have someone's help. We are all in collaboration with somebody at some point in our lives, that none of us are self-made. And so I saw her saying to me that night in that conversation that life is about collaboration. Just like you see this jazz band over here in the corner playing, it's about collaboration. At the same time, in a jazz ensemble, as you well know, Brother David, you also get a chance to solo. And so there are going to be times when you have a chance to do your own thing, to step out front and to solo. And so I've had the experience in my life of being a part of any number of ensembles and working collaboratively. This book project is a collaborative project. And yet, you know, there are moments in life where you also get a chance to be a solo artist. And so, I mean, every time, the thing about the stuff that she said, which is why it's so important for me at least to have kept as many notes as I've kept and to hold on to these memories and to even read her own works, is because her stuff is so textured. It's so textured, it's so layered, that every time I read one of her poems, every time I reread one of her books, every time I go back and listen again to one of our public radio conversations that I conducted or watch one of the PBS television shows that she appeared with me on, every time I go back into any space with her, David, I find something new. There's something fresh. There's some new takeaway that I find because her stuff, again, is just so textured and so layered that it feeds me every time I return to it.
On the flip side of that dinner conversation, I want to go there with you for a minute, if I may.
Sure.
Which is that you alluded to occasionally, and it wasn't all peaches and cream. Occasionally, you all had your differences and your discussions, we'll call them. That same dinner conversation came to a very abrupt end when a couple of, as you put it, well-dressed brothers at the bar who had had a couple too many began loudly throwing the N-word around.
Yes.
That's a word that Dr. Angelo would never tolerate. And you both leave the restaurant. Later that night over coffee, you agreed to disagree, I guess, on the modern use of the N-word, but you learn a lot more on the topic. And then much later, and this is the point of the book where I'm actually in tears, just thinking about it, you learn Dr. Angelo's perspective in a really beautiful way from her stage work with Richard Pryor, used that word. What strikes you about that debate today? And can you just recall that moment for me?
Well, let me go to the end. I'll back up. After having had this conversation with her about the N-word, she had no use for it whatsoever. She said to me and to others countless times, if I have poison in a bottle with skulls and bones, and it says P-O-I-S-O-N on the bottle, it's poison. If I take that same poison and pour it into the most beautiful vase of Baccarat crystal, it's still poison. I don't care what container it's in, it's still poison. And so she had no use for it, and the context did not matter for her. And again, because we have a generational difference between the two of us, I saw the word different, and I think that people can own words. I think people can take the sting out of words. I think certain words are owned by certain people, and they get to decide how those words are used. I think that sometimes you can use certain words lovingly. And again, we just had a back and forth, and it's one of those things we never agreed on. There were a couple of things that we never agreed on. One was the N-word. The other was this debate about love and courage. But we never did agree on that particular word. And yet, after that conversation, you know, when I went back at home, they were rerunning some old episodes of Richard Pryor's NBC show, his comedy sketch for NBC. And there on my screen, after we had this conversation, was the most beautiful sketch that Maya Angelou did, basically impromptu, a sketch that she did with Richard Pryor, where she is talking about the N-word, and I can't even do justice to it in this conversation. One has to read the book. And I took her words verbatim from that television program that night, and how she basically brought to the fore her understanding of that word and the pain that comes along with it and what happens when we call ourselves the N-word.
And then you called me a nigger, Willie. And then if there was ever any affection in it, it disappeared. Because you started using it to curse me, to curse yourself, to curse the whole race.
What do you miss most about her?
Oh, Lord. Now you're going to make me tear up. The access. Knowing that if I needed her counsel, if I needed her advice, that I could call and get it. I mean, I reflect all the time on how did I end up being a part of her inner circle? How did I end up in her space? How did I end up being one of her sons? How did I end up going to Africa with her and having this life-altering, life-affirming moment with her. How? I don't know the how. I don't know the why. I just know that I'm grateful.
Well, Tavis Smiley, we are very thankful for you and for offering up this wonderful book, My Journey with Maya. And thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to chat with me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity, David. It's been a great joy. Thank you, sir.
Okay, all the best.
Stay strong, brother.
All right, right back. Talk show host, political commentator, and best-selling author Tavis Smiley. His new book, just out this week by Little Brown & Company, is titled My Journey with Maya. The book release takes place on Thursday night, April 9th at 7:30 in the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art in Winston-Salem. Tavis will share more stories about his 28-year friendship with Dr. Maya Angelou, and there'll be a presentation, reading, and book signing. I'm David Ford, and there's poetry and percussion, dulcimer and dreams, and film coming up after this break.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. In just about 20 minutes from now, David Ford will return with Ken Bloom's boundary-busting bowed dulcimer, a 21st-century percussion ensemble, and an exploration of the connection between imagination and dreams. We also have Bethany Chafin in conversation with poet Valerie Neiman, whose new book, Hotel Worthy, was just published by Press 53. But first, my look at a documentary from this year's River Run International Film Festival. The Winston-Salem-based artist Diana Green has built her artistic career around exploring memory, community, and the beauty in the everyday. As a photographer and storyteller, her strength is in capturing the wonder and humor of people and materials that are often taken for granted, or perhaps never given a second glance. With this in mind, her latest creation, a documentary on the last days of a time-honored rummage sale, seems a perfect fit. The final rummage will be screened during the River Run International Film Festival. It's part of the North Carolina Shorts program on April 19th and 24th. For details on this and other River Run films, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
The final rummage is about the last of a 60-year tradition in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It's a wild two-day frenzy of shopping. Bargains, bargains, bargains. It's 60,000 square foot space filled with used clothing, used lawnmowers, and there's just a wide range of people that come in almost like a sports event, Eddie. It's just crazy. The energy of it is a little ESPN because they only have such a limited amount of time and there's so many great deals to be had. And it's people from every zip code. Everybody comes there, which I think is my great attraction to the story itself, was just this conglomeration of people with this great zesty energy of finding a good deal.
Well, you really get that energy off your film. Everyone who's going to it is so pumped and so happy and so excited. Just this really pure joy and like enthusiasm that really comes across.
I know. There's a guy who just wanted bike handlebars. Like, why? But I just felt the need for a lighter story in my own life, actually. So when I was checking out and they told me the year before it was ending, I had a pretty strong visceral moment of, this has got to be a film because it's just very visual. It's so playful. It's so funny. And it's so full of characters. I just celebrate all the people who were there because it's a little bizarre, too. You know, it's a bizarre sort of campy story. And I think that there's something so beautiful in the bizarre if you really look closely at it. I have a very warm-hearted feeling towards everyone that I met in this story, strange as they are at times.
It seems like everyone in your film is unguarded and pure, which is... that's what you want when you film a documentary.
People were way more open than I would have imagined. And I think you catch that intoxication.
Why was the rummage sale started?
The rummage sale began in 1954 by the Junior League of Winston-Salem. And I think it just came about because perhaps we had a little extra after World War II. And there was a way to share with the public who wasn't as fortunate the goods and extra that some people have. And so that was before... really the Salvation Army and Goodwill and thrift shops and consignment and all the things that happen now that we're familiar with. I think it was a new idea and it was a fundraiser for them. So it helped the community, but it also raised tremendous amount of money for the other work that the Junior League did in Winston-Salem.
And what's the significance of the Junior League in Winston-Salem then and now?
Well, that's a big story because it started in 1923, I believe, with Catherine Reynolds, a debutante, probably the wealthiest woman, right, in Winston-Salem, mm-hmm. married to the tycoon of tobacco, RJR. And she started it, as many debutante women did, because they wanted a way to have agency in the world around them. They were privileged, but they didn't have much to do in the way of social contact, probably. I'm just mm-hmm. imagining what it would have been like to be a very privileged white woman back then. And, you know, not to give tremendous sympathy to people who had everything, but to really be effective in the world was not as easy for women back in the day. It was very elite, but that changed quite a bit. Also, I think what's significant about the Junior League, and I didn't know much about it at all when I started this project. I am not a Junior League member, and I had a misguided idea about what they did. And they are the silent troopers in this city. They have started so many great organizations that we take for granted in Winston-Salem, like CyWorks, Children's Museum. They helped with the Arts Council when it started so long ago in 1954. They are instrumental in beginning things and helping nonprofits start.
So you didn't know this going into it. So what drew you to this subject matter?
Well, I was a big Rummage Sale fan. Now, I wasn't as hardcore as the people you see in the film. Like, there's Deadheads, and then there's people who like a couple of songs by the Grateful Dead. And I think I'm more in that latter category.
Right.
I would go every other year, every third year, and I would only look for one thing, which were cashmere sweaters, because you could find them for about $2. But I always loved going. It came every April. Just when the dogwoods came out, you would go to this rummage sale, and I counted on it. And what I liked about it most of all really wasn't the sweaters. I did really love the people. There's so many people to look at, and there's so much stuff, and there's so much good energy. It just felt like the only time in Winston-Salem where I would see all kinds of people, every race, every class, every age, all gathered in one place for a really fun moment in time.
Tell me about some of the people you worked with on the film.
12 people worked on the film, and it all started with John Funstein, who lives in Winston-Salem and is a great cinematographer. And we worked together preliminarily to see if this even made sense. He was fantastic. We also worked with Wade Wilson, who is the sound designer. He's a professor at UNCSA. Magnificent talent. We felt very lucky to have him with us. And of course, Ian McLaren, who's just key to everything because he's the editor. And making sense of Rummage wasn't the easiest trick in the world, and he just did a fantastic job.
The music was produced by a local artist as well, right?
Right. So we were very fortunate to meet someone that you probably have known a long time, Kike Rodriguez Pastor. He was beautiful, and his music fits so well with this feeling of joy and a little nostalgia. And so we were thrilled that he was part of the project as well.
Well, why is it the final rummage?
That is what we probe and try to find the answer to. And Eddie, I think there's a lot of answers to why. I think there's a big generation gap. That became quite a theme as we started asking, especially the Junior League members, that the women today, 90% work full time. This is a huge amount of work, and I think that's part of it. Sometimes I think it's also that we're changing as a society, and we're much less likely to want to spend time physically touching things and moving things, and we can go to eBay. Maybe that's, I think when I get a little down about it, I think it's because we're just becoming more separated. But I think that the larger issue for the Junior League, as they would tell you, is it just wasn't as cost effective as it had been. They were not making the kind of money that they used to make. The final sale made about $22,000 in profit, and at its peak, it had made $100,000. So I don't know where they'll make up that money. It's still a lot of money, but it was just from a ratio of effort to outcome, I think they decided it was time to end. And that's why we called it the final rummage.
So the film is showing as part of the River Run International Film Festival. That's exciting.
Oh, it's a thrill. We are so happy to be in River Run. I can't tell you. It's going to be running twice with the North Carolina Docks. We're really honored to be part of the lineup, and I think and hope that a lot of people will come in Winston-Salem and surrounding areas, because if you're missing the rummage this year, first time it's not there, you can kind of get a hit of it by coming to the movie, because it is, like you said, so experiential, and it's a way to say goodbye one more time.
Well, thanks for coming in, Diana Green.
Thank you, Eddie. It was great talking to you.
filmmaker Diana Greene. You can see The Final Rummage during the River Run International Film Festival. It's part of the NC Shorts program on April 19th and 24th. For more on this and other River Run films, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia, and you're listening to Triad Arts Weekend, where every week we bring you an hour of arts that connects to the Piedmont and beyond. Just like our next guest, award-winning poet and novelist Valerie Neiman. Her new collection of poems is titled Hotelworthy, and it was published by Press 53 on March 20th. Valerie celebrated earlier this week with a launch party at Scuppernong Books. Of Neiman's poetry, former poet laureate of North Carolina Joseph Bethanty has said, "Neiman knows the names of things, how those things piece together, how they sunder, and while she refuses to lie, her truths are exquisite." Neiman is a professor of creative writing at North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro. She teaches at the John Campbell Folk School and has held writing and poetry fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the North Carolina Arts Council. Valerie joined Bethany Chafin at WFDD to read from her new collection and to discuss the art of naming.
You've expressed an interest in the concept of naming things, and you elaborated on that to say that it's to see, to know, and to identify the world. Where does that interest in naming come from for you?
I think I treasure experience. I treasure the world in its variety, and to apprehend something is to take hold of it, and for me to name it and to pay attention. The one thing that I think the poet does above all is to pay attention to things large and small and not let them get away. And I guess I feel some urgency. Maybe it's the time that we live in, that the glaciers are crumbling, the seas are rising, that, you know, of taking hold of this precious thing. I was always so attracted to the scene in Faust where, "Stay, moment, you are so fair." And there's that, you know, don't go away, don't be lost. And I think that that's part of my makeup, that I'm constantly wanting to hold something and not let it escape. And so I think that leads to the naming, which is really prevalent in this book and was not in my first.
That act of holding something and appreciating it, for you, is it best exercised through writing about something?
I think both. I think that I really like direct experience. I love hiking or kayaking or sailing or gardening or something where I'm physically in the moment, but then in reflection to be able to go back to it and find it and set it in some kind of larger pattern. Even something like that tiny little poem Release came from an experience I'd had 20 years before, and just at that moment it rose back up from somewhere. So all of those moments we hope are not lost, that they stay with us, but we know they won't be, that we lose memory and eventually we lose life and they go away. So I think while I can, I want both to experience, but then also to record experience.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned things that we lose, things that go away. Those are also themes within this collection. And I wonder, do you feel that writing some of the poems that deal with a sense of loss or a sense of trauma, is that at all therapeutic? Is that at all a healing process? Or is that also just kind of a respect of a moment or an experience and a capturing of it, a holding on to it for what it is, even if it's difficult?
I think it is more of the holding. Therapeutic, I don't know. I think for many people it is. I feel an urgency to write certain things, but I don't feel an urgency, say, to write a memoir or, you know, I move things around through poetry and approach them from a different angle more than facing them directly, I guess. So I would think it's more the moment, which is intense, and that I want to keep. You had mentioned you'd like the poem In the Middle of Things, and that's just such a, you know, sort of a, not a pleasant moment, but It's a moment that I remembered. In the middle of things, We are fighting as we turn into the parking lot with a view of the lake going down to red clay with the August heat, the lake turning its back on the green shore against which it has happily spooned for months. An eagle is lifting away from the backwater behind the marina, white tail flaring and white head like paper flung from a window, like anything that makes our eyes cut, showing whites. We are fighting about the usual, those things we fight about. And the eagle is carrying something long and limp, a snake or a water-soaked stick to add to the residence, beating black wings to gain altitude. And if we were not fighting, I might have said, "See, the eagle." And if you were not staring out the opposite window, you would have noticed.
I wonder, as a poet, are you always striving for a little more specificity in what you write?
Yes. I really urge that with my students because it's easy to just say the tree. And in this poem, it's like, did you see this specific, not just a swallowtail, but was it a pipevine swallowtail? Was it a spice bush swallowtail? And it does make a difference. So we are getting, it seems to me, more and more divorced from the natural world and being able to know what things are. I take my students out and have them just sit and pay attention because they don't. Most of the time, you know, we're engaged in electronic things and we have buds in our ears and phones in our laps and we're not just being in the world. And they're often amazed. Like, I never paid any attention to that tree. I didn't notice the little creatures. I didn't hear the birds. And now I do. Again, that's what poets do, I think, is be present in the world and remind us, here we are, pay attention. It's all we have is that moment. We never know what more we have. The world is too much with us.
One of your poems where I see the natural world merging with a more personal world that I assume is part of your own experience is The Life Inside. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the story behind that and then perhaps read from it.
Several of the poems in here are about my father. And I didn't mean to leave my mother out. It just happened that this group of poems have a lot to do with my father. My mother's passed, but my father is still very much with us and very lively, and I'm very happy for that. But he suffered a lot in his life with psoriasis, and so that's in here. And this is going back to childhood again and the kind of things that you do when you live in the country. The Life Inside. He would peel the bark from wild cherry trees, lash it into tiny canoes that, set adrift on our creek, might have prowled their way as far as town, passing under the concrete bridge where fish shot back and forth across sunlight. And maybe they kept going, just going. He made three cuts, two to girdle, one to free the glossy outer bark, damp with sap and pliable for working. But if I kept the boat safe in my room, those not put to water soon dried, pulling apart at the seams. As for the trees, well. These days my father sheds like a hickory. He grows by shattering, leaves showers of skin wherever he sits, scratches at the gray lignified layer, rough, dead, until the inner red shows, where he has year by year exchanged life for life. Farmhand, infantryman, metal bender, artisan, bartender, chaplain, one by one completed and put to the stream, away, away.
Something that I spoke with another poet about, she was discussing the fact that a poet is a time traveler and can traverse time and space and not only do it between different poems, but within one poem. Is that practice hard or does it just come naturally?
Robert Bly called it leaping and talked about the Chinese idea of catching the tail of the dragon, I think is what he said, but that one thing will leap into something else. And so I'll think about one thing in the present and it will make a connection with something long in the past. And it may be because of something sensory. It could be a smell, particularly. Smell is very, very evocative and brings up the past. It could be a sound. I think everyone has the experience of hearing a song they remember from sometime in their past, and immediately the past comes just completely in front of you, and you can see the bank where you were sitting and the person you were next to and all of this stuff. So those leapings between time and across space as well, I think, are really important in poetry today. And I treasure it when these things happen because they're unpredictable. You start out with something that is catching your attention, some moment of sensory impression or something that grabs you. And then as you follow, and hopefully you catch that tail of the dragon that takes you somewhere else and takes you into the past, and you realize why it was that moment was so important.
Poet and author Valerie Neiman. Her latest collection, out from Press 53, is Hotel Worthy. Neiman's other works include her first poetry collection, Wake, 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 and her novel, Blood Clay. You can hear Valerie on April 6th at the Greensboro Public Library, where she'll be reading with Mark Smith Soto and Judith Behar. The event begins at 6:30 p.m. She'll also be reading at Tasteful Beans in Hickory, North Carolina at 7 p.m. on April 14th. For more information and a list of Valerie's events, visit our website at wfdd.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia, and this is Try It Arts Weekend, your one-hour dose of arts administered by 88.5 WFDD, public radio for the Piedmont. We have to take a short break, but when we return, its imagination and music informs new and traditional when Try It Arts Weekend continues.
Welcome back to Try It Arts Weekend and a look at what's happening all around us here in the wide, wide world of arts. The 11th annual Pilot Mountain Bow Dulcimer Festival kicks off this weekend thanks to organizer Ken Bloom. Ken's a lifelong musician and luthier who studied Indian music, performed in Turkish and gamelan orchestras, and he feels equally at home with jazz improvisation, blues, and folk. Ken's a great guy. He's super funny, and I know you're going to like him. He's also a gifted instrument maker, and you'll find his beautiful dulcimers all over the world. He brought one along with him just last week during his visit to the WFDD studios.
I've always thought that you can play anything you want on any instrument you want. It's just a matter of giving it sufficient time and hubris to be able to do it, you know? The bow dulcimer, for me, makes it possible for me to play a bowed instrument and not have people run screaming from the room. I've always told people I am what you call fiddlistically challenged. I attempted to play violin for literally decades. I sound rotten on the violin. The position and the bowing and all that, I could never be relaxed. And if you're not relaxed when you're bowing, it's always going to sound really awful.
People don't realize that. Violin playing may look easy, but it's actually a real contortion of the body. It leads to a lot of physical problems.
Yeah. A lot of people who've gotten bow dulcimers from me are people who were violinists in high school and got stress injuries, and they can't lift it up. They got a shoulder thing. They can't hold it up anymore. And I make a small version of this, which I call the Part of Seuss after the Part of Seuss de Vial Gamba world. It's tuned just like a violin, so it's like holding a violin upright and playing it. Gotcha. And I've made quite a few of those for people with violin injuries. So,
describe this beautiful instrument you brought in, Ken, because it's, and this is for the magic of radio. We can't see this now, but I'm looking at it. Just the wood itself and the exterior is gorgeous.
This one is Macassar ebony back and sides. Macassar ebony is one of the denser of the rosewoods. It comes from Indonesia. The top is spruce. This would be basically what they would call a teardrop-shaped dulcimer rather than the hourglass. And that allows my left hand to actually get to the frets.
It's about 36 inches?
Overall, it's about 36 inches. The string length's 25. It kind of looks like a dulcimer. Mine are chromatically fretted.
Basically, what you're giving us is all the keys on the piano, but on your bow dulcimer with
exactly.
frets.
Exactly.
Now, how do you play the thing? And I want a demo. I want to hear some of this.
Okay. I take my bow. This is the standard one, so it's got three strings.
Now, it looks like you're holding it sort of like a cello.
I'm actually holding it the way they used to hold Baroque cellos before they bothered with end pins.
Uh-huh.
So I just hold it between my legs here. It's tuned D, A, D. Just like most dulcimers are tuned.
Just three strings.
Just three strings. Any more would be sheer vanity. So, with one hand, using this D-A-D tuning, I can play... So I can reach that much without having to shift my hand or do anything else. That means playing... You know, you can play fiddle tunes all day long and never have to get out of first position. I also sing with it, you know. You can do the real old-time thing of, now, buddy, get up and come here to your pap. I'll tell you a story, climb up in my lap. It's better than the story of Daniel or Ruth, and although it is fishy, it's every bit true. And that goes on for 15 verses. You can just... I could do, you know, do nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said. Why people tear the seam of anyone's dream is over my head.
So that's great, Ken. Now that's just too much. You're laying down a bass line. You got the guitarist accompanying you there, and it's all on this three-string instrument. That's how long did it take you to get to that level of? I mean, that's just great virtuosity there.
Well, I've been messing around with this for about since sometime in the '90s.
Oh, that's all.
I guess, you know.
But the beauty of the instrument, I mean, for those not able to play an instrument, not the most difficult to learn for somebody just wanting to get in and playing an instrument.
What I love about dulcimers in general and the bow dulcimer in particular is that you can sound pretty credible at whatever level that you want to do it. I have people who are real beginners and they play just nice, slow tunes. And once I get them to get their arms moving in a real relaxed fashion, they calm down. You know, they're so calm down. Get centered. Okay, we're sitting on our butts in the chair now and the arms moving out from there. And, you know, you get them to relax and then they can get a pretty decent sound. They get to where they can play stuff in first position and play some slow tunes. And we have a really great bow dulcimer community of people. They're very supportive of one another. And we just have a lot of fun.
Musician, luthier, and festival organizer Ken Bloom. We've been sampling from his CD, Ken Bloom Journey. Ken's 11th annual Pilot Mountain Bow Dulcimer Festival begins Friday, April 10th, and it'll run through Sunday with evening jam sessions at the Pilot Mountain Econo Lodge, classes during the day, and a concert open to the public Saturday night at 7:30 at the Pilot Mountain Friends Meeting on West Main Street. Tickets are available at the door the night of the performance for $10. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and next up, percussion. The University of North Carolina at Greensboro School of Music, Theater, and Dance provides some of the finest arts training in the country, and the percussion program there with Assistant Professor of Percussion Eric Willey is no exception. Eric and his colleagues are transforming their percussion students into marketable professional musicians, and they're doing so by offering a wide range of instruction and experiences. Foremost among those is percussion ensemble life, where students collaborate on performances of challenging and engaging music utilizing UNCG's comprehensive inventory of percussion equipment from around the world. Next week, Triad audiences will get a chance to enjoy this dynamic ensemble in concert in the beautiful Recital Hall on campus with music by John Cage and an extremely challenging and exciting premiere by Adam Silverman. It's titled Sparkle Frog. It's loaded with unusual but potent combinations of percussive sounds and instruments played in traditional and non-traditional ways. We're sampling from it right now.
There are two guitars. One is tuned basically in a B major chord, one's tuned in a C major chord. And we're playing them with sticks. But we have to play the specific strings, like he wants the specific notes. So that's what you hear at the beginning of the piece. And then the long tones over that, we're playing melodicas.
What is a melodica?
It's a piano that you're playing it with the wind of your mouth. So it's kind of like a reed instrument that you're playing through to push the wind through, and then you hold down the keys to get the notes to come out.
Oh, yeah. I've heard street musicians play that, and those are very popular. I guess it's so compact, it's easy to carry it around. But what a neat sound, and fading in and out like that, a very ethereal effect. A relatively long piece, this one, for percussion ensemble, clocking in at 11 minutes, and it's intense, really, from beginning to end. Is it tough to sustain that level of concentration?
It is. Yeah, it moves rather quickly from one, I call them sound windows, you know, from one to the next, where you've got the high metal sounds, crotales, and the vibraphones and glockenspiel, going to the marimba low sounds, even to the guitar that you hear in the opening.
What are the biggest challenges for the musicians?
Color and balance. We spend a lot of time picking out mallets and shaping lines and those kind of things and just dealing with the idiomatic tendencies of the instruments.
You're also performing music by John Cage, whom I love, and this is a big work of his, I guess, in the world of percussion ensembles, Third Construction. And I don't know why this still freaks me out with John Cage's music. It was written 70 years ago, but it does not sound like it. There's some really interesting sounds he generates there and some interesting instruments, too. What all are we hearing?
Oh, yeah, it runs the gamut. And the instruments that we're choosing to use, we have some dundumbas, which are some large double-headed drums from Guinea in Africa, to a lion's roar, which is basically a stick coming through a head that we rub that sounds like a lion roaring.
That is such a neat sound.
Yeah, and we have two of them. We have a high and a low that are asked for in the piece. Several different rattles, a quejada, which is originally it was like the teeth rattling like a skull of a horse or something like that, that you would hit and the teeth would rattle, and that's what we're kind of looking for in this. We're using a vibraslap, and there's tin cans, conch shell that you hear at the end that kind of cues the closing of the piece to China cymbals. There's all kinds of colors in it.
People sometimes hear, John Cage music, and they, I'm talking about the cynics among them, they roll their eyes and go, oh, yeah. Chance music, but this piece is a really great example of some of the real complexity in his work.
Yeah, and it's very much a numbers game in the piece.
Explain that element of it, would you?
Yeah, it's actually a rhythmic structure. It's 24 sections of 24 bars. Each section is 24 measures, and then overall there's 24 sections of the piece. And so it's actually very organized. One of the things that I find fascinating about the constructions is that although it's percussive, as far as what the performers are asked to do, it doesn't take a lot of, rudimental training because it was originally played by dancers.
How about that? It's kind of like the Terry Riley's piece, In C. It's kind of inclusive in that way.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good parallel.
Post-concert music is going to be provided by the UNCG Steel Band, and in this neck of the woods you say steel and people think of pedal steel or something like that, but we're talking about something very different. What's a steel band and where does it come from?
Yeah, well, it's a very new instrument. Talking about 41, it's of John Cage's Third Construction. It's very much along those lines. It's about the same time that it's from Trinidad, from the Second World War, that these instruments, the barrels started appearing on the coast.
Oil barrels?
Exactly. And so sometimes you'll hear them as steel pans, which is actually like a frying pan. It's kind of credited to a person named Winston Spree, and he was credited for kind of beating on a frying pan, like a mother's frying pan, and having different pitches. And that same thing happened with the oil barrels, that they were able to beat them in and have different notes on each one. And so you think of an oil barrel, the larger pans, they'll have a full skirt or the full length of the barrel, and then you could trim them down and they'll have things like a cello, and they're kind of, you know, equated to like an orchestra. So the lead pans are like the violins, and then there are guitars and cellos and bass pans.
Outstanding. Well, Eric Willey, thank you so much for talking with me today. I appreciate it.
Man, I appreciate you talking to me and hearing what's going on at UNCG, because we've got some great things here.
UNC at Greensboro Assistant Professor of Percussion Eric Willey. The performance is Tuesday night, April 7th at 7:30 in the UNCG Recital Hall. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Did you ever dream of becoming a percussionist or a drummer? I know I did. And my next guest is busy helping people and communities bring their dreams to life. Cheryl Cirillo grew up in the small town of Midland, Michigan, where she immersed herself in the arts and community service. 6 years ago, she became involved in the national social media and social capital scenes, and eventually helped launch both the Echo Network and Storyline Project. Her Bridges Connecting Communities is her hyperlocal website dedicated to collaborative storytelling. Then came an idea: what if she could unleash the power of imagination, one dream at a time?
I was sitting at my computer one day, and I got a tweet from my friend Kristen Dokas, and she was standing in the Imagination Room at the Dallas-Fort Worth Art Museum, and there were all these pieces of paper flying around the room. They had some kind of wind technology, and she took a picture of one that said, "I dream for a living," and she tweeted it to me. And I'm like, wow, that is so fun. I would love to do something like that in Winston-Salem. So I took her tweet and I put it on Facebook. And I said, who wants to come together and brainstorm about an imagination project for Winston-Salem? And 5 days later, 20 people came together at Camino Bakery. And we started dreaming about what that might look like in Winston-Salem. And the name Imagination Installations was born on that very first day. I brought the idea of Imagine If to the table, but one of the women who is now on our board of directors, which we call a vision circle, she said, no, not Imagine If, let's use Imagine When. Because when people speak their dreams like this in the positive, when these dreams cross-pollinate with each other, they will happen. And then the other thing that was really cool on that very first day of brainstorming is we said, wouldn't it be cool to have a digital billboard on Business 40 where people's dreams in our community were showcased? And that has also happened. And we had digital billboards on Business 40 for over a year, and they're about to come back.
What I love about it is it sparks dialogue. I just wanted to share some of the others that we've come across online and here today. Imagine When: Liberal and Conservative Ideas Merge for the Good of the World, from Tim. Imagine When: We Really Know Our Neighbors comes from Gail. And how about this one?
This was from a student at the arts-based elementary school, and they said, imagine when jetpacks exist and we can fly over the haters.
Flying over the haters. There's an image. And then imagine when everyone embraces the power of their imaginations, from Cheryl Cirillo. And Cheryl, it's a great sentiment. Are there any rules to these?
The only guideline is that you dream about what you want instead of stating what you don't want. Because we believe that, like, when you dream about, you know, imagine when it's not a rainy day, you're just creating a bad feeling about not liking rainy days. And so you want to dream in the positive. So imagine when I appreciate the beauty of spring and all its many formats.
The power of positive thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, how do you, and I guess that's the reason you're here today, really, to talk about how you're building on this Imagination Installations concept. What are some of the ways coming up?
Well, we like to use interactive public art as a way to share people's dreams and collect them, and then have this really dynamic, exciting cross-pollinization creation. And the first one is coming up on Friday, April 3rd, at the Milton Rhodes Art Center. We're creating our first really big, large-scale, interactive public art exhibit. Associated Artists has invited one of our artists, Ren Wilson, to create something. She's using Mylar reflective shapes that she's cut into all kinds of different lantern, octopus, amoeba shapes that will hang from the ceiling in 12-foot and 8-foot long strips. And they will reflect dreams from the community that we've collected. And her other idea is that when you walk in amongst this mylar forest that's hanging from the ceiling, you will also see yourself reflected because you are the one that needs to take the steps to make your dreams possible.
Connector, storyteller, and conduit Cheryl Schirillo. On Friday, April 3rd, it's the Dream Party Art Opening from 3 to 8 in the Milton Rhodes Art Center. The interactive public art installation by Ren Wilson, Reflecting on Dreams, will coincide with Associated Artists of Winston-Salem's Amalgamation, an exhibition of mixed media artwork. And on Saturday, April 25th, you can become an active dreamer at the Dream Seeding Booth at Piedmont Earth Day Fair. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org. So many dreams, so little time. So climb aboard the dream train of imagination installations. But that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Elena Dolman. You can follow us on Twitter at Triad Arts Speak. And you'll find podcasts and archived episodes at WFDD.org. Just click on Triad Arts Weekend. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions about this show or any other Triad Arts Weekend program you've heard, please send them our way. Our email address is triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.